Shrink Wrap Radio number 347, Somatic Experiencing for Trauma Work, with Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guests today are Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen, who have adapted somatic experiencing to deal with trauma in a child protective services setting. Susie Gruber, MA and SEP, holds advanced degrees in chemistry and psychology. She spent 15 years in biotechnology before returning to her first love, helping people and transforming their lives. A somatic experiencing practitioner in private practice in Sebastopol, California, Susie assists practitioner trainings while piloting an effort to apply somatic experiencing to the child welfare setting. Jerry Allen, MFT, MPH, psychotherapist, health educator, musician, and currently in training in somatic experiencing. With 23 years in child protective services helping families undergoing abuse, stress, violence, and addiction. He also has 3 black belts in Aikido and a lifelong interest in resolution of stress, conflict, and development of healthy families and communities. Now, here's the interview. Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you, David.
Yes, well, it's good to have you both on here. I heard about your work from a mutual friend, and then we had a chance to meet in a Starbucks, and I was impressed by both of you and what you're doing. So let's get right into it. You're both practitioners of Peter Levine's somatic experiencing. How did you each come to be involved with this approach?
I was introduced to the approach by a friend of mine who fell in love with it. He's somebody who works with couples and fell in love with the approach because he was getting much better results working with couples with somatic experiencing than what he was doing before that. And I got hooked literally after the first module of the practitioner training because it resonated so deeply with my body wisdom.
Well, I had no idea that it could be applied to couples work, so that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
How about you, Jerry?
Well, I was in a long career with Children's Protective Services and very troubled by the fact that the trauma that we were seeing was really not being addressed successfully with many of the modalities that were being used, and the outcomes are very poor in CPS. So I was on about a 3-year search for some method of intervention that could really work. And I met Susie, and she told me about somatic experiencing, and I went to some introductory workshops and was very impressed with it and became involved through that approach.
Now, did either of you get training directly from Peter Levine or from one of his teachers, of which I'm sure he's got many out in the world at this point?
Yeah, both of us, our core training is with other faculty, but I have studied with Peter directly in some very specific post-advanced workshops, such as working with near-death experiences and really diving into how memory and emotions play a role when we work with somatic experiencing.
And I've worked with him only a little bit. I have a day-long workshop coming up with him on the 17th of April.
Oh, well, when you see him, let him know that I really would like to interview him. I think I've sent an email or two to the name that you gave me of the person who kind of works as his assistant. And I think maybe he was too busy at the time or something. But if you have any way of getting a plug out there, I'd love to interview him, not to denigrate you two as representatives.
He's representatives. Wonderful.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've heard.
He's a great proponent of this methodology.
Sure.
And I will do that, David. I'll be with Peter for 4 days in April, and I will make a good contact with his assistant while I'm there.
Oh, good. Excellent. Well, take us through the main concepts and practices of somatic experiencing, if you will. I know you can't do it full justice because it takes work, many workshops, it sounds like.
Yeah.
But maybe you could kind of touch on the highlights.
Definitely. So I want to start with a definition of trauma. The definition of trauma that I'd like to use for this purpose is any experience that we have that couldn't be integrated physiologically or emotionally because it happened too fast and was too much. And so that's a nice broad definition that includes everything from event-based trauma like a car accident to chronic childhood abuse. And basically what somatic experiencing does is it uses an understanding of the human threat response to help the practitioner create an opportunity for the person to work with unprocessed survival energy. So the key with trauma is it's a perceived life threat. And when there's a perceived life threat, what happens is there's an activation of energy directed towards surviving, because we are inherently programmed in our brainstem to try to survive whatever happens to us. And so the brainstem threat response includes the typical fight, flight, freeze response. And when those responses don't get to fully complete, that energy gets stored in the body. And it turns out, Peter discovered that we have the same mechanisms for discharging that energy as animals do. So he asked a really simple question. He said, why don't animals in the wild get traumatized when they're experiencing life-threatening situations several times a day? And what he discovered from copious reading in the stacks and at the library at Berkeley and watching a lot of video is that they actually have a mechanism for discharge, and so do we.
And that mechanism is?
Well, what happens is if we provide a space for a client to really get in touch with the experience of what's left from the event. So, for example, if you're working with somebody, classic example that we use a lot in the training, there was a firefighter who was shopping one day, and nearby in the parking lot, a car ran headlong into like a light pole at high enough speed that it was a pretty severe accident. And so he reached through the driver's side window to kill the ignition so that there wouldn't be any further fire or anything like that. But at the same time, he looked over and he saw that the child in the front seat had been very, very badly hurt. And he had come to the practitioner he worked with what's called a frozen shoulder, where his shoulder just literally wouldn't move.
Wow.
Yeah. And so what got set up in his body was a conflicting impulse. Like, he reached in to turn off the ignition. So his arm was reaching in one direction. But then when he saw what had happened to the child, his brainstem sent the signal to his somatic body to move away from the horror of what he saw. And so it set up conflicting motor responses in that shoulder. And so the practitioner was able to help this man stretch out the experience enough that both of those impulses could complete, and his shoulder was fine. No surgery, no pain meds. It was just done.
Good story. Please feel free to sprinkle in any other stories or examples as they come to mind. My recollection from looking into doing a little reading on Peter Levine's work was that what he found was that animals in the wild would tremble, would kind of shake it off. And so I'm wondering how the story that you just gave us relates to that observation about animals.
Yeah, absolutely. So when a client touches into that kind of somatic movement that didn't get to happen and the movement gets to complete, often there is a discharge that's felt. Maybe it's through that specific arm, or it could even be the entire body. And that can look like shaking or trembling or tingling or pulsing or heat moving in some direction. And so, yeah, we see that all the time with clients. I was working with somebody the other day who touched into something and just suddenly had this big rush of energy move through. It's very common.
David, I wanted to add one little thing to that. What you said about stretching it out. That one of the key things about the way somatic experiencing is practiced is that stretching it out process that we help the client slow down the experience so that they can notice more. It's sort of like if you're going along at 60 miles an hour, you don't see much of what's going by the roadside. It's kind of a blur. But when you get really slow, then you have a chance to pay attention to what am I actually feeling or experiencing in my body right this moment. And that is often required for the person to really get close enough in touch with what that experience was about so that they can begin. For that shoulder, for instance, that man couldn't go through that quickly. It took time to really tease that out so that he could experience what was happening in his shoulder.
Sure, that makes sense to me. Now, you two have adapted somatic experiencing to put together a program for low-income parents who are clients of Child Protective Services in Petaluma, California. So, first of all, tell us about the need for such a program.
Okay, well, Children's Protective Services, dealing with client families where there has been abuse or neglect, that's a very big piece of government services. We spend about $53 million a year on it in Sonoma County, nationwide about $35, $40 billion. And the outcomes in Children's Protective Services are really poor. At best, in Sonoma County, only 40% of the people get their children back who lose them or whose children are removed. And we really... What we find is that most of the families, I could say all, but almost all of the families that we deal with in Children's Protective Services have a trauma history. Very often, it's a complex, stacked up layer after layer of trauma from their own childhood experiences to then becoming parents whose kids are removed. So it's a trauma-filled client pool. And what we just were talking about before, about needing to slow things down and take some time and look at all that, these people aren't able to do that. They have lives that are often filled with homelessness or chronic job loss, drug problems, domestic violence, all those kind of things. So they are not handling the trauma that's in their lives. And when they come into CPS, often they lose their children just because they can't recover quickly enough. They can't solve the problems. And yet most of them love their children. So we recognize that there is an impetus on those people's part to try to heal. They would like to do a better job as parents. They want to be good parents like everybody else does. But we needed to find a more effective way to work with them that could be directly addressing lowering their trauma load so that they could emerge as better parents.
Now, is everyone that you're working with, have they all had their children removed?
No, some have had their children placed under the custody of the court but still remain in the parents' home. If the parents can be working on the problems and the problems are not so severe as to have to have been removed. So we've worked with a gamut of families from what's called voluntary family maintenance, where they have some problems, but we don't need to take them to court, and the CPS social worker is working with them, or maybe they've gone to court, but the court has chosen to leave the kids in the home of the parent. So we worked with some of those, and then also worked with some families where the children have been removed.
Now, you started off talking about trauma, and I'm guessing that there might be a wide variety of traumas that you're working with in this population beyond the issue of the family breaking up. Are there traumas that come up from the past? For example, maybe rapes or automobile accidents or other kinds of traumas?
There's quite a wide variety, and you know, one of our intentions with this model was to make it cost-effective and yet still effective for the clients. And so what we offer isn't the full-blown trauma renegotiation the way somatic experiencing is typically practiced in private practice, where, you know, someone might work with a practitioner for, you know, several years. And so what we're doing instead is we're focusing on helping these people experience nervous system stabilization and improve self-regulation. And so what we discovered, and this is visible in the literature, is that you don't actually have to help renegotiate all those traumas in order to achieve good enough parenting, which is the standard that CPS works with. It turns out that if we can help these clients actually settle and lower their stress even just a little bit, it improves parenting outcomes dramatically. And so, yes, we see a variety of different traumas, but because of how we're working, the different categories, in essence, don't matter based on how we've structured this model.
Okay, well, tell us a bit about the format. Are you working with clients in a group or individually?
We offer each caregiver a group of 10 to 14 one-on-one, one-hour sessions with a somatic experiencing practitioner. And what we focus on, we've kind of got it broken out in sections of the intervention. The first couple of sessions are really about building a relationship and a sense of what we call attunement with the client. And that's really important because the CPS intervention itself is such a disruption to these families that often we have to spend the first session or two just hearing about how hard it is for them to have CPS involved. And so that builds a level of trust with the practitioner. And then from there, we really begin to teach the client how to track their own experience. So, for example, you know, for those of us with some level of body awareness already, if I say to you, you know, what are you noticing right now? You'll probably have an answer to that. But somebody who has never really been all that aware of their body level experience would have a really, really hard time with that question. And so we spend a lot of time teaching them how to track their experience in the here and now and what happens when they get triggered by something. So, you know, if their kid acts up in some way, what do they notice on the inside and what are the signs that they can track? Because that tracking helps them create the possibility of a different response, which may be what got them into trouble in the first place.
Are you two working as a team, as a pair in these sessions, or do you work individually with each of you having your own clients?
Yeah, we have about three practitioners that see clients, have seen clients in this program so far. We ran a pilot program with seven families, and there were three practitioners involved. Jerry wasn't one of them because he was still working at CPS as an employee at the time that we ran the pilot last year. I saw clients and then two other people saw clients. And we do that because we really want, we want a variety of possibilities for the families because some of the effectiveness has to do with practitioner fit as well.
Okay, so I take from your answer that you do work individually rather than as a team.
That's right.
And what about, I know there are a lot of Spanish-speaking people in this county. Do either of you or any of the other practitioners speak Spanish?
I speak Spanish, but not well enough to hold a session. We do use interpreters when necessary. We actually had a Cambodian woman in our pilot program, and I did about 10 sessions with her through an interpreter. So we are making adjustments for that when necessary.
How did that work out with the Cambodian woman?
She was one of our success stories. She had a great outcome. Her big issue, it was so fascinating. Her big issue was working with a lot of cultural norms where she was putting up with behavior from her child's partner that was really abusive. And so we did a lot of work. I did a lot of work with her in tracking her experience and then learning to set boundaries. And it resulted in her making a really good choice for her and her son in order to live in a safe environment. She got a lot from it.
And I'd like to make a comment about that case as well, which is that one of the things that Susie was able to do with that client very successfully, she mentioned that on the front end of the work with the client in the first session or two, you're spending time making a connection there. And it's hard for people who are clients of CPS to identify with the goals that CPS has placed for them, like what the things are that they need to do. So it's really crucial if the practitioner can make a connection there and help the person understand what CPS sees that they need to do and how that relates to their own desire to be a good parent. And if you can make that connection, as Susie did with that Cambodian American client, then things really begin to shift, because the person then can see the work that you're doing with them as a resource and as a help rather than just something the government is laying on them. So it's a really crucial shift that happens in the first couple of sessions so that then the work can be fruitful.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, one of the things that drew me to wanting to interview you two is that I think I was somewhat surprised to hear that this was going on in an agency like Child Protective Services. So I'm wondering if this is unique, or if there is anything that is unique about your application or use of somatic experiencing.
Well, I wouldn't say it's utterly unique in that there are practitioners who are beginning to be involved with public agencies in a number of different places. There's someone in a county north of us who's beginning to explore it. I just got an interest from a social worker in British Columbia who wants to do something there. We've sent her a copy of our article about our program here. But it is fairly unique in the sense that this is the first county of the approximately 5,000 counties in the United States. It's the first county where there has really been a direct CPS-focused somatic experiencing program, and where it's actually been designated as an emerging practice puts it on the road toward promising and then evidence-based practice. It's the first place in the United States where that has happened.
Well, that makes you two pioneers, so congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
They say pioneers have arrows in their back. Do you have any arrows in your back?
Oh, I'm sure we do. You know, one of the biggest challenges when I think about arrows in my back is that the clients are mandated to come. So, you know, the pilot program clients were chosen by their social workers to come and attend, and we had great success with three or four of them, and then the other three or four it wasn't a fit and they didn't want to come back. And that is such a classic problem within CPS in general, that clients have a hard time following their case plan. And so, you know, some of the arrows come from that direction.
Sure.
And another one that has been a difficulty is that many government programs, including CPS, want to work with things that are evidence-based already. And as Dr. Bruce Perry put it very eloquently at a conference in Austin in September, he said, you know, if everything's got to be evidence-based, then how do you actually do any innovation? Because you can't innovate something if it's got to already be evidence-based.
Yeah.
You have a conundrum there. And he said that the kinds of things that we need to do to effectively treat trauma are mostly not evidence-based yet, and yet we really need to do them. So, yeah, that convincing process of helping government officials get the idea that we need to really try some of these kinds of trauma treatment, even though they're not evidence-based yet, because that's how we're going to get them to be evidence-based, is that's a hurdle that we have faced and continue to work with.
Yeah, that is such a good point. And also the challenge of working with people who are court appointed or required by the court or required by some other agency, that certainly is a hurdle that people have had to face in a lot of different situations. And yet one of the things that I've learned is that despite the resistance that somebody might be going through because the court makes them go see a therapist, that nonetheless, I've heard that therapists are able to negotiate that and get it to where the person kind of gets on their side and treatment can be effective. And it sounds like that's been your experience as well.
Absolutely. Part of how we're addressing that is in the first couple of sessions where we're focusing on relationship building, is that in addition to tracking physical symptoms, which is one of the things we track in this program. We also work with the client to establish two or three goals of what outcome they want to have from the experience, so that we're really enlisting them that this is for them and about them, and it's not just, oh, you have to do this, you know. And that really helps.
Were the requirements that clients had to meet in order to qualify for participation, you know, beyond that somebody says, okay, you've got to do it, were there certain criteria that the people who are setting the requirement that they're, you know, looking at to say, yes, this person would be good for this approach?
Yes, and we've oriented the social workers who are making referrals to some of those key issues, like, mm-hmm. for instance, the client needs to be someone who appears able to benefit from this kind of an intervention and is willing to try something new. Someone who isn't open, like, you know, they're so angry at the government that they don't want to attend any services. I mean, we're obviously not going to have them dragged into the office. So it has to be someone who's willing and interested, and willing to try something a little different than maybe the therapy that they've been sent to a number of different times.
It also has to be somebody who's really clearly wanting to become a better parent. There seems to be a pretty big variety within the CPS caregiver population where there are parents who just genuinely, their kids are just not their first priority. And working with those folks is really, really difficult. And when I look at the families where we had success, in all cases, the caregivers that we worked with were really highly motivated to improve how they were showing up in order to serve their kids better. And that's just, you know, we can join them all day in that.
Yeah. Now, getting back to some of the mechanics, how often are the sessions?
Once a week.
And how long is each session?
1 hour.
And is attendance by clients mandatory? It sounds like it is, or is
yes.
it optional?
It's mandatory, and you know, while we'd like it to be every week, the reality is that it can take, you know, it can take much longer than 10 weeks for them to get their 10 sessions in, because, you know, childcare problems and transportation problems and other commitments, and it, you know, oh, I have to meet with my social worker that day, and it's a difficult challenge to get them to be consistent.
Sure, I can.
The parent-child issues that are present in each of the cases are a huge piece of the presenting issue with CPS. But we have chosen to focus on the parents as the clients who come to the session, because we perceive that the parent is the regulating force for the child, is the one who helps the child. So even if the child is having trouble in school or whatever is going on with that child, we want to help the parent to deepen their capacity to regulate their own nervous system and calm themselves and use settling skills in order for them then to be able to be the co-regulator for their children more effectively.
Well, it sounds like you just mentioned a couple of treatment concepts there from the somatic experiencing when you talk about calming themselves and settling skills.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell us about what some of the skills are that you focus on in
sure.
this approach.
Sure. So when there's trauma, what generally happens with someone is either a presentation of being stuck on, and that's the hypervigilant, anxious, you know, can't slow down type, or the stuck off, which is the depression, the chronic fatigue, that kind of thing. And so it's an inherent dysregulation in the natural rhythm of the nervous system. So, you know, every day, if we're pretty healthy, we go through natural excitement and then settling, and excitement and settling. And that can happen from difficult things and from positive things. And so the focus in somatic experiencing is really on restoring that ability to self-regulate. And of course, this is absolutely essential with parents because children learn to self-regulate from their parents. And if the parents aren't able to do it, then it, you know, they pass on that dysregulation to their child. And so really working with teaching skills that help a parent settle. Like for some parents, the notion of actually calming down is totally novel. I love to talk about our very first client because she's really become just, our poster child for how this could go. This was a single mom with three kids. When she started the program, all we kept hearing was that she had absolutely no ability to settle herself and was driving her kids nuts. And her kids at the time were 13, 10, and 8. And there was a very, in this case, the kids hadn't been removed from mom yet, but she was headed in that direction because she just could not make good decisions because she was so anxious all the time. And she ended up doing 12 sessions with an SE practitioner, learned a whole bunch of ways of settling herself by orienting, for example, to the actual experience of petting her dog. Like it's not just the cognitive experience of like, oh, I can pet my dog when I get stressed. It's actually teaching the client to really be present. Oh, well, what does the dog's fur feel like? Well, as you notice the softness of the fur, what do you notice? What do you notice? Oh, well, I feel better. Oh, okay. We'll just let that happen. You know, so really, really connecting her with what she was already trying to use to help herself feel better in a much deeper way. And the cool thing about this particular case was without the practitioner's urging, she ended up teaching all those skills to her kids. And so the kids ended up learning how to settle much better. And the result was that the case was completely dismissed from CPS. She has gone off and is now in a healthy relationship and is doing much better. And Jerry, do you want to talk about the financial implications?
Yeah. So with those three children, for example, the oldest child was on the autism spectrum, and we were getting ready to have to put him in a high-level group home, which costs about $9,000 a month. And wow. That could be for, you know, until he's 18. And then the other two kids would have had to have been in expensive care. So by diverting that process, we were able to save between $150,000 and $200,000 a year of government money. We estimated by not having to place those children in out of home care. And then, I mean, that's the financial piece. And if you look at the emotional piece for those children, that oldest child had never been able to be hugged. He has problems that were pretty intense, but through what his mother did with herself, she was able to reconnect with him in a way that she was able to begin to give him hugs, to tell him she loved him, and to make him feel more enfolded and more part of the family. The human value of that is just priceless for that youth. So there was tremendous good there, and that client, before she left our agency's involvement, she came in and told us that her children had sat down with her and said, "Mom, we really don't really understand everything about what you're doing with those sessions, but we really like it."
Wow. What a great testimony. You know, your decision to work with parents rather than with the children directly, it keeps bringing to mind the old story about somebody is standing by a riverbank and they see babies keep floating down, and they're trying to pull them out as fast as they can to save the babies, but they just keep coming and coming. And there's that level of intervention versus going upriver and finding out who's tossing the babies in the river and stopping them. And so it sounds like you're the people who have gone upriver and are stopping them.
You know, it's interesting that you shared that story, because what we've discovered in our very small pilot here is that the program appears to have greater benefit before the child's removed. So the families where the parent is involved in CPS but hasn't yet had the kids removed, for some reason, and of course we don't know why, we're getting better outcomes. Now, I know part of it is that a couple of the families that we worked with where the children were removed, there were major extenuating circumstances that just made it, they just weren't present for what was happening and ultimately decided not to continue. But it really is an upstream intervention, and that is a big part of our motivation, is that if we can keep the trauma of removal from happening, it's a huge win.
And if you look at all of the issues that surround the whole idea of sequestration that's going on in the federal budget right now, I just came back from a meeting hearing about that. Well, you know, government budgets are under stress, and the problems that are being dealt with are huge. So if we want to look at how can we most effectively keep those babies from going down the stream, we have to go upstream in order to try to effectively intervene in a way that can use scarce dollars to greatest effect.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That's going to be a very strong arguing point in today's economy. So I know you talk about the pressure to be evidence-based, and so I'm wondering, are you tracking outcomes, and what sorts of outcomes are you seeing?
Absolutely. So in the pilot program, what we were tracking, we were tracking symptoms. And so at the first session, the practitioner would go through an intake form that asked a bunch of questions about, you know, are you experiencing anxiety? Are you experiencing insomnia? That kind of thing. And then the practitioner and the client together would pick kind of the three symptoms that the client would most like relief from. And then the practitioner would ask the client, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, where 5 is horrible and 1 is the symptoms almost gone, the practitioner would ask the client at the beginning of each session, okay, where are you? And then at the end of each session and through the whole 10 session series, so we could really see a change in the symptoms. And that we chose to do that because there was a somatic experiencing program at COTS, which is a homeless shelter in Petaluma, that used a similar tracking approach and was seeing really good results. So that's one big thing that we're tracking. We have, in order to get to the next level of collecting evidence, we've put together a very detailed program evaluation. And in that program evaluation, we also want to track some outcomes, you know, start and end points reported by the social workers. And so, you know, it's things like, is the child stable in her home placement? Is the child stable in her school placement? You know, does the caregiver have the capacity to participate in safety interventions? That kind of thing, kind of more social worker type questions that are very relevant to the CPS context.
And I'll add that we recognized as we began to look at how to conduct evaluation that we were not going to be able to put together the kind of control group, double blind kind of study that would be typical of some other kinds of research. That's not really feasible to do within this kind of a context. But by using pre- and post-testing and looking at the pre-intervention levels of functioning and levels of symptoms, and then post-intervention, we are able to do some analysis of what the impact of the interventions are.
Yeah, great. Susie, sometime way back, you mentioned that Jerry was an employee of CPS at the time. And so that causes me to wonder, who's paying your salaries? Are you working for Child Protective Services, or have you come in as consultants? What's the setup?
Yeah, so the people providing sessions have contracts with CPS. And so that CPS contracts with lots of different service providers to provide different sorts of interventions for the clients. And so that's how I was able to provide sessions. All of the program development I've done, and Jerry and I have done together, without being compensated. So,
although I was welcomed by the county agency to participate in the training in somatic experiencing, they actually helped me pay for that, and then they allowed me to work on this program development as an employee of the department. So I was receiving my salary. So for Susie, it was a much greater financial sacrifice than for me in that sense, because we developed all of this together and I was getting a salary.
Well, you guys are doing good work. What have been the outcomes for your agency, Child Protective Services? Is it too early to say, or do you have some sense of that?
Of the pilot program of seven families, three of them didn't continue. They either went to jail or didn't want to continue, or just didn't show up for any more sessions. I guess that's another way of saying didn't want to continue. Of the four families that did continue, I would call three of them pretty much home runs. We had really great success there. Aside from the one that Susie mentioned, that first client, we had another client where the child was having great trouble in school and was being, had police called sometimes. He was a middle schooler. The practitioner, by working with the mother, was able to help this mother settle herself enough that, by illustration, the next time he had a problem in school and the police were called, the mother showed up, and the school told us afterward they were incredibly impressed at what a huge calming influence the mother was. She was able to calm her child and not need law enforcement involved in that. And this is a family that had been involved off and on with CPS for 12 years.
Wow.
They no longer need to be involved in CPS. So we've seen of the three families, the Cambodian family, this one that I just mentioned, the other family, three of them, one, the jury is still out a little bit as to what their final outcome will be, but we essentially see a couple $100,000 of savings, if you're talking dollars, and diversion of families from further CPS involvement. I signed the court reports. Well, I retired December 29th, but I was still working there at the time, and I signed those court reports asking the court to dismiss the cases on those other families, because CPS didn't need to be involved anymore. And that's a huge outcome success for CPS.
Now, you refer to the pilot program, but there is a program that's going on now, right?
It's actually not. Where we're at right now is we're seeking funding to run a bigger program with 50 families. And so we've put a proposal together to take it to the next level. And the funding is the big issue of getting the sessions covered. So we're looking at different ways of getting funding. There's an RFP process through CPS where they, got different sources. And then we're also looking at community and nonprofit sources.
Do you think that this is a model that would work for other agencies?
Absolutely. There's a lot of cities around the country where there's a significant number of somatic experiencing practitioners where I think this could be, certainly be effective. And it really takes an open-minded leader at CPS, coupled with as you said, kind of entrepreneurial pioneer in the SE community to implement this. And I think it could be easily implemented in other places because the program is constructed in a way that it uses very simple SE principles. There's really no magic involved.
And so I take it that means that it would be relatively easy to train practitioners?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, Jerry and I, when we put this program together, we got tremendous support from Ariel Giretto, who is a somatic experiencing faculty member who trains practitioners. And she actually put together a little training for SE practitioners who want to work in this kind of setting to teach them what issues to consider when working in a brief model in an agency setting. And so it would be quite easy, actually, to train people.
You know, I have a lot of listeners who are clinicians, and I'm sure some percentage of them work in agencies of one sort or another. What if somebody wanted to contact you to, you know, put their heads together with you to talk about what their situation is and what advice you might have, et cetera?
Sure. I'd be happy for them to give me a call. My telephone number is 707-888-9646. That's probably the best way to reach me. We love to talk to anybody who's interested in this kind of thing, because Jerry and I really started this with the goal of spreading it far and wide. As excited as we are about doing it in our hometown, there's so much need.
Would you be comfortable giving your email address as well? For example, a lot of my listeners are in the UK, as it happens, and, you know, they're dealing with these kinds of issues as well in the UK and in Australia.
Sure. It's SUZIE at SUZIE, GRUB as in boy, ER as in Robert, .com. So it's Susie@SusieGruber.com. And they can also go out to my website, which is www.SusieGruber.com, and check out more information there on the CPS program.
And mine is Jerry@SomaticHealingNetwork.com, and I also have a website that they can take a look at.
Okay, and although that sounds like we're winding it up, actually another thought that I want to put in here is, because somatic experiencing is being used for trauma in lots of settings, and I'm thinking it must be under evaluation for veterans who are returning from our various wars, who have suffered a lot of trauma, I would think that the evidence base for its effectiveness would be being built up in other settings like that.
Yeah, there are people that are working in that setting. As the VA has realized that the meds just aren't really working, they're becoming more open-minded to other possibilities. And there are a couple people in Southern California, for example, who are making inroads into the VA. The real trick is doing the evidence-based work. There's a lot of places where there have been, you know, success with vets and with the military, but there hasn't been the kind of documentation, you know, really detailed, explicit documentation of what's been done. But that's beginning to shift, and the core organization for somatic experiencing is called the Somatic Experiencing Trauma Institute, and they're in Boulder, Colorado, and they're very interested in developing a greater evidence base. The evidence base that's out there right now is primarily focused on more trauma first aid, using somatic experiencing, for example, for hurricane victims. There was some work done with the victims of the tsunami in Southeast Asia and that kind of thing, and very good results. But really, there has not been enough evidence, actual, you know, good evidence collected at this point.
There are practitioners working at Walter Reed Hospital. I met one of them at a recent training in Bethesda, Maryland. They're doing that work directly with veterans there. But that, like Susie just said, the missing piece is actually getting the research done to collect the data in a way that can really give that evidence-based designation.
Sure. Well, what do you see in the future for yourselves and your work in somatic experiencing?
Well, in addition to this project, I also lead workshops for agencies and schools and medical providers, teaching people about trauma and how the threat response works, because it helps people make sense of how their clients present, and it really shifts the focus of intervention from how do I get this person to stop doing that to, wow, this is a really natural response. Their nervous system is behaving exactly as it's supposed to. How can I join with that and help it, you know, help the person actually feel better? And so that's really exciting work for me, because it's, you know, one-on-one work is great, you know, working with one family at a time. But when I can work with people who are going out into the world and working, you know, much more broadly with people challenged by the impact of trauma, then the effect is, you know, is amplified quite quickly.
And to add on to that, I was at a meeting earlier this morning with one of the program directors of an agency where Susie conducted a training not too long ago, a two-day training teaching social workers there how to intervene with clients. And I asked him this morning, what are you hearing from your staff who attended that two-day training? And he said, you know, even the people who were reluctant to come said, wow, this really was valuable. It's really impacted the way I see clients. And they're seeing it in the notes that people are writing about how they're using the skills that they learned in intervening with clients. And we love to hear that kind of thing, because to have an impact, you want to see that kind of response. You don't want it to be just a cognitive thing where people go to a training, go home, and they forget about it. We want to see it actually impact the way people work with clients.
And so what do you see for yourself in your crystal ball, Jerry?
Well, I see continuing to find ways to bring this body of interventions to settings where it can do the most good. You know, you want to apply leverage. Look for the places where you have the greatest leverage. I want to look at interjecting this into systems like school systems, where you have guidance counselors and other people who have the potential to have impact on a lot of young people. I want to see it introduced in more settings where young parents are trying to learn how to parent their children, so that parent education can be more deeply enriched by learning how to see one's child's nervous system and work with your child to help them be relaxed and be settled and able to be more effective in their life. So continuing to look for opportunities to bring this to settings where we can have an impact.
Well, I must say I'm inspired by both of you, by the good work that you're doing and your altruism and your desire to spread what seems to be very effective work. So Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen, I want to thank you both for being my guests today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
It's clear to me that my two guests today, Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen, are leading values-driven lives. I really admire the altruism that comes through in pursuing their chosen vocations. It's clear that money is not the prime motivator for this pair. Sure, they have to support themselves somehow, but they are clearly putting service ahead of financial gain. Hopefully that came through to you as well. As you heard, I'm also very impressed by their decision to focus on working with traumatized parents as a way of benefiting the children. That approach really makes a lot of sense to me. Even though they have only a handful of case examples at this point, it's clear that there were substantial benefits to the mothers and their children, as well as substantial savings to the various government agencies involved in the chain of care. I do think that the somatic experiencing paradigm developed by Peter Levine shows great promise, as we heard not only in this interview, but in two others on this topic. I'm thinking of Shrink Wrap Radio number 307, Freedom from Pain, with Maggie Phillips, PhD, and also an interview with George Lau, PhD, on somatic experiencing in my Wise Counsel podcast series, in May of 2012. These would make great companion pieces for this interview if you've not heard them. Also, I will keep pushing for an interview with Peter A. Levine, the master himself.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Tim here. I'm a psychologist from the Gold Coast, Australia. I was thinking recently it was about time I got off my butt and contributed some money to your wonderful program. It's given me so many hours of pleasure and education, especially on the drives to work. And I think it's important to support your mighty efforts, Dr. Dave. So I'd urge everyone out there to donate, contribute some money to make sure your show, very fine show, Shrink Wrap Radio, is around for a very long time. Okay, see you later.
Thank you, psychologist Tim, there on the Gold Coast of Australia, for your very tangible support and for your encouragement for others to join you in doing so. Come on, folks. Tim said it. I didn't. Get off your butts and help support this show so that it may continue long into the future. You know, I have to say that I'm getting a special place in my heart for Australians. I'm finding that I have a large and growing audience there, and one that includes quite a few professionals like Jim. I've never been there, but is there some way I can become an honorary Australian? We have a new transcript on the site. It's number 325, Reflections on the Anima Mundi with Jungian analyst Monica Wickman. I want to publicly thank Elizabeth Thompson for taking on that transcription and doing such a fine job for us. Also, I want to call your attention to a new magazine and related journal titled The Neuropsychotherapist. You'll find a link to it in the right-hand sidebar on our site. Speaking of great Australian listeners, this online periodical is the creation of Australian listener and serial entrepreneur Matthew Dalitz. He has done an incredible job of recruiting outstanding neuroscientists and psychotherapists as contributors. He's also assembled a stellar advisory board, of which I'm proud to be a member. The periodical is visually stunning. Matthew has also included some of the transcripts from my interviews and has utterly transformed them visually, making them things of beauty, which consequently also make them easier to read. So do look for that link in the right-hand sidebar just below the Amazon.com widget, or you can just go to www.neuropsychotherapist.com. Finally, I don't know if you're aware of it, but I put these shows together over a number of recording sessions over several days or more. And as I record this segment today, it's with a heavy heart, because just yesterday was the bombing at the Boston Marathon, in which people lost their lives and many lost their limbs and suffered other grievous injuries. Even though I live on the opposite end of the country, of course I can't help but feel impacted by this. Also, I have a son who lives in nearby New York City, and I'll be traveling to New York City next week. We still don't know who was responsible for this act of violence. Even though I'm a psychologist, it's hard to fathom individuals who would inflict this kind of harm on innocent people. I know people in other lands have had to learn to put up with this sort of thing for some time. I guess we will learn more empathy for all who suffer in this troubled world of ours. It certainly challenges us, challenges me, to stay in touch with whatever faith and hope sustains us. So in that spirit, I will carry on here with my work as long as I am able, as we all must. That being said, I think I will close off here for today.